Welcome to Day Zero Update for December 7th, 2025. I'm host Chris Elogi.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Daniel Victoria.
And yeah, we've got a big week of news. We had a few showcases happen, though I did not put up a summary for any of those because they were all fairly smaller ones, but did have some interesting stuff get announced. So we have some of that stuff here for that. We have a bunch of industry news as a bunch of things have happened. Some studios, or at least one studio, on the verge of shutting down. We got Netflix stuff going on. We got more news on horses, as well as, let's say, people on the internet being dumbasses. And we'll get to all that here in a bit. Yeah. But before we start the show, we'll talk about what we've been playing. And I'll kick it off here. I've been playing some Metroid Prime 4. I'm not too far into it, maybe about 2 hours. Basically, I've gotten to the second area, I guess. The second place where I think I'm about to get the motorcycle. Maybe kind of go through some stuff there. And so I'm kind of wandering around a bit. I'm basically... this area has a bunch of storms and it's powered by the lightning strikes, and where I'm at, I've started turning things on and then I have no idea how to get out of this room. So I'm stuck where I'm at right now. But I've been enjoying it so far. I've basically gone through, there's an intro that's kind of more action packed than your typical Metroid opener. You're kind of joining this, battle that the pirates are waiting on the Federation force, and you kind of do some stuff before you go to protect this artifact, and then the artifact gets shot at during the boss fight where Silex shows up and does his thing, and a bunch of people get transported to this other world. It seems to be outside of the typical space that they know of, so they don't really have any way to get help. They're kind of dealing with the people that are there, and so far I've met Miles McKenzie, the person that all the previews were complaining about, and so far he's not been that big of an issue. He's certainly a dumbass dork, especially in the early parts where you get your first big encounter with enemies when you find him and his ship, and he just drops his gun immediately as he tries to grab it and kind of just has to hide while you take out the enemies. Then later on, he's kind of walking around with you and you find this big bridge you need to get across, and he decides he's just going to book it instead of like staying behind the experienced bounty hunter as enemies sort of swarm all over the place. So I guess that's kind of an escort mission of sorts, because he does have a health bar there, and so I'm like hanging back to take shots at enemies and try to avoid as much damage as possible. And he's just like running around like an idiot for whatever reason. But then you get to like a base essentially that you can kind of all hang out in, and that's not a place that he has left so far. But from there, you kind of go to do a boss fight. And I thought that first boss fight was all right. I feel like it, for the first half of it, it made sense. And then the second half, it asked me to know a mechanic that I didn't know yet. Which is that when you get your psychic abilities, which is like all, seemingly like what all the upgrades are, you have a thing that you can do where you, when you charge your shot, you shoot out a blast that can be directed. I hadn't really used that too much at that point, nor did the boss fight really seem like it needed it. Because up to that point, it's essentially a plant boss that has tentacles that pop out with little like bulbous areas that you shoot to destroy it. And you essentially break through the armor around it and then keep shooting it to destroy it. And the first couple phases, you're just doing that and have to do it quickly enough to take out, you know, one, and then you have two at the same time, then you get three. And I was like, okay, so I just got to take all three outs, and I was basically doing that, and nothing was happening. And I realized after like 10 minutes of doing this over and over again that the issue was I was supposed to be doing the guided shot thing to take out all three, because it slows down time as you're doing it and all that. So that was the solution. Jeff was pretty frustrated that that was the solution, not the thing I was doing. Then you get to the last section where it's basically said barriers between the different tentacles, and then you know, have to guide them through holes in those barriers to get to the next thing, kind of thing. And you beat that boss, kind of get to the you don't get to the open world, you get to a big cannon that just shoots you out into the middle of nowhere, it seems like. Where, as usual, Samus trusts the weird machines of this world to do whatever and not be trying to kill her at any point. Also, she, like every other game, basically trusts any alien sort of energy that wants to inhabit her. And so she gets this psychic power from them that then becomes sort of the basis of your abilities, and you scan things with that. You could do it before, but then once you get that, you kind of use that as part of the psychic moveset. That's how you activate certain doors that have to have things moved around on them. And some other stuff at this point. So yeah, you're kind of working your way around, and I got to the secondary where they show you the motorcycle, Viola. And that is kind of where I am at, trying to get the suit upgrade that will let me use it. And it's sort of an interesting place, but yeah, I'm kind of stuck in a pit right now. That's, I should be able to use this elevator to get up, but it's not working. So I have to look around and try to figure out what thing I missed. There's one area sort of off to the side that seems like we're off to get a grappling hook of some sort to get around. But the ground is all electric, as you'd expect in the electric area. And yeah, I can definitely understand the way this is being described as like Metroid Prime meets Ocarina of Time, as far as you have these big, essentially like dungeon areas that going between, and you have sort of barren areas between them that maybe have some enemies and some other stuff going on, but are mostly just a means of getting some distance between these areas to make it feel like a bigger area than it is. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. Enjoying it. And it's very much the it does things that no other or very few other Nintendo games ever do, which is like have options. It has full options for like setting up all your audio stuff for different kinds of things. Is definitely in contrast to the update that Mario Kart World got this week that adds a new music volume option that just has normal and loud as the only options.
Yeah.
Whereas this has, you know, full 0 to 100 kind of thing for music. Or any of this stuff, it also has gyro options. So if you want to use the Joy-Cons like Wii remotes, you can kind of do that. You can also use the Pro Controller to be sort of the maybe like Breath of the Wild style of gyro controls, where you can essentially aim, try to aim your weapon, and you can then aim it with moving around the controller. They also have some that seems to control your cursor with the gyro, which I did not like at all. But yeah, they have plenty of options for that stuff and ways to tune it if it's a little too loose or tight for you. As well as a bunch of other things. There's difficulty options for this game, which is neat because there really isn't difficulty options for any Metroid games. It's the one difficulty, and then maybe there's a harder option when you beat it the first time. But here you got an easy mode and a normal mode, and then there's a difficult, a hard mode that unlocks after you beat it the first time from that. And yeah, it seems like a pretty solid one of these. I'd say, so far, not a fan of the boss stuff at the moment. It did take me a bit to realize that when you're charging your shot, the you kind of vacuum up any health drops and whatnot around you. Didn't really make much sense, and much like the second half of that boss fight being kind of a confusing annoyance, I'd seen this happen, but I did not know what I was doing to cause it to happen. But as you, they do have like things in the menus that'll explain mechanics more, and that's where it's explained, but it wasn't, didn't seem like it was explained when it had me start doing it. So now I'm actively using that more. Even though I'm full right now, it does throw. It seems pretty easy as I've been starting this game, because I've already gotten health upgrades, so I'm up to 199 is the mat. Or no, I have two. I think I have two health tanks, and my missiles are already up to, I think, 25 is my max, about 2 hours in. So they're kind of throwing a lot at you early on. And I'm sure there'll be some more stuff happening here. But yeah, I would say difficulty, like the only times I've been close to dying is in the boss fights. That's because I didn't know that you could suck in all the health drops that are happening. They're, you know, sitting in the middle of the air that I can't reach. I don't have the double jump I started with. They do have all that kind of extra abilities at the start in that intro sequence, and then you lose them as you get teleported to the new world. And also, a lot of the environment design here is clearly like genital related. A lot of the doors look like vaginas.
Yeah.
In some interesting ways. I saw people be like, did George O'Keefe design this game?
Look, it's not George O'Keefe's fault that a lot of the flowers in the Southwest just look vaguely vagina like.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I mean, the original Metroid, much like a lot of games back in its day, was heavily inspired by the Alien movies. So, you know, the sort of vaguely sexual imagery is not really out of character.
No, those games were 2D. So you had a little bit of, I don't know, like direct relation to the design of things.
Just yeah.
The doors from the side. And it's like, that could be whatever. Like,
yeah.
Star Trek doors or whatever. But here they're all kind of that kind of teardrop shaped kind of thing. So, you know, fun little design. It looks really nice. Audio wise, seems fine. I think maybe my biggest issue is that Samus doesn't talk at all, and it's so she just looks like a weirdo, just having Miles ask her questions, and then she just stands there and is like, does the thing instead of talking. Like, she doesn't have to be talkative, but she could certainly do a little bit of, you know, yes and no's or anything like that. But yeah, that's been pretty much what I've been seeing of that game. The weird thing is, it seems like in the motorcycle stuff, if you have the, I forget which of the amiibos, one of the amiibos allows you to use the radio on it. You listen to music while you're driving across the desert areas, and that's not something that unlocks any other way than besides like a $30 or $40 amiibo, which is annoying. It seems like there's some other useful things that those amiibos also provide. I forget what exactly there is for that stuff, but that also seems kind of unfortunate for a lot of this. So yeah, that's kind of where that is at. But yeah, what else I've been playing? I've been playing some Mind's Eye. I got this during Black Friday. It was $20 at Best Buy, and I was like, I'll try this out just to see what it's doing. And I played a couple hours of it, and this is obviously after a bunch of updates that have happened over the past few months. It's a very weird game. It feels like if you made an Uncharted game through the lens of the way GTA works, in the sense that it kind of just runs you. You can, when you pause, you can look at like the missions you've done, and you've seen that you've done missions just constantly. It just does not appear the way like in GTA where you go to a specific spot to talk to a person or activate a mission. It's just you do a thing at the end, character's talking to you during cutscene and then tells you to do something else, and then that mission's already activated. It just kind of keeps it going as like a narrative story thing, and you're just kind of continuing to play, which is nice to see because it gives us the vibe that you're in this big open world city thing and you don't really have any access to that, unless you just decide when you're driving to wherever you need to go for a mission to just not do that and do whatever. But I don't think there's anything really to do in the world. It seems set in some future world where you are this guy that used to be in the military that had these this mind's eye tech implanted in you, essentially like a neural implant, I guess. And you're like one of the last people that has still has it, has not had it removed or anything. And then you're finding out you're visiting your friend who's getting you a job at this big tech company, who sort of gets wrapped up in some things, finds out the person that created the mind's eye worked at this business and has their office up at the one part of the building. So you immediately try to go up there and try to see if you can find clues to help you with the issues you've been having, which is that you kind of have your mind hijacked every once in a while, essentially. Like he's going into some sort of like, not about like a coma or something, but like going through some thing where he is just kind of zoning out, and usually passes out as a result. So he's trying to figure out like what the hell this is, what it's doing to him, and all that. And as far as I know, the story, you come to find out that the corporation is bad and all that, and you try to take it down, I believe. And do all that, and they try to kill you with their drones and all this future tech you have, and all that. And it seems like it's set in a like a Saudi Arabian type area, big just desert area with some clean man-made city type thing, and all that. And it works kind of what you expect, but the issues where it seems like, oh, this was definitely rushed is like a lot of the transition scenes where you see textures and such just don't load in as soon as they should, and so you get like a good split second of like, oh, here's this looks bad and now it looks okay, kind of thing. And it's like, oh, they still need work to do for this, but also they got bigger issues with that stuff with whoever is still left at that company. And the interesting thing is like they had like when I broke into the guy's office, they popped up this like mission that comes from Arcadia, which is the user generated content side of the game. Though all the content I saw was made by Build a Rocket by the developers, but I don't know if there is much of that surfacing or if it's platform related. I think the creation tools might only be on the PC version, but I don't know if that translates over to the console versions at all, if there's cross-platform stuff with that. Who knows? But it had me go through this weird mission that was essentially like us trying to rescue a hostage out in this section of buildings. And that was pretty not fun, because it was just a lot of like this. It was a nighttime mission, and seeing enemies was pretty hard, and the lock-on wasn't as strong as it feels like it needs to be to make up for that. And it's got all the cover shooting kind of stuff that you would expect, but it all just doesn't feel very good. And then just pops you back into the campaign. But it does give you leaderboards and such. I'm like, I don't know that I care about any of these leaderboards or anything, because I don't it didn't seem like there was any way to really access any of that. But yeah, it's one of those kind of games that seems like it had grander vision for it, that they had to finish a game, and so they cut out a lot of it. And you can see like little pieces of bigger things that could have happened for this game that just never materialized, which then led them to having, a bad game that was unfinished, because they focused on a variety of things that some of which didn't make it in. And so you're just left with a game that's just unfinished and not particularly fun. It's not terrible, but it's not particularly engaging. Like I said, the most quality thing about it is it just kind of goes through the missions and doesn't stop or anything. Doesn't really allow there to be any downtime. Though I did have some fun times where I was like driving to different parts of this facility with their little vehicles and went to go do a thing, came back and the vehicle was gone. So I had to run it all the way back to find a new one because they're not. You're like in part of the security of this organization. And so like there's one of the early missions is this guy seems to have stolen something. And you kind of follow him with the drone and all that. And figure out where it is, and then you get there later. And they're like, hey, don't get too close. You might spook them. This gang that's looking around for this thing. And of course, he just drives up right close to him and just gets out and they start shooting. And he's like, confused why that happened. It's like, this doesn't make sense for a guy that used to be in the military that can, follow orders and understand the idea of not alerting people that you're trying to spy on kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, there's some not great writing in this. But yeah, like, the best thing about it is just kind of keeps going. So you can kind of just zone out and just keep doing things, shooting dudes and walking around and driving some places and all that. Yeah, that's Mind's Eye. Not worth checking out unless you're just interested in games that are really interesting failures. So there's that. Let's see, I've been playing some more Ball Pits. I've just been working through unlocking more achievements as I beat these stages with characters I hadn't beaten them before and trying to get the achievements for beating a stage or beating all the stages with each character kind of stuff. I've unlocked all the buildings and at least made them all. Now I'm working on upgrading them at this point, so working my way through with that stuff. And also been playing some more Clair Obscur Expedition 33 as I've gotten to the Gestrel village, and I'm kind of looking around, seeing what quests are around here. Because if I'll say there's any like issues I have with this, there's some of these like side quest stuff that you could easily miss without ever really knowing they're there. They don't really highlight them, as far as I can see. If I didn't have this guy that's like showing me where these things are, like I would not have looked in, because some of these in the Gesture area are pretty well hidden if you weren't paying attention. But I got a couple that would require me to have specific kinds of builds for them, and I'm just like, I'll come back later for that stuff. I'm about to do the tournament arena thing, so I can go to the next area. But yeah, still enjoying that, and that's been pretty much what I've been doing. So how about you, Brandon?
Well, as for me, I've been taking advantage of my PS Plus subscription and I've been playing Neon White, and I played a little bit of it, back on the PS4 back in the day, and I liked it. It was pretty fun. I never got really far into it. But I'm actually like taking it seriously now and actually taking a point of like trying to get, gold in every course and trying to find the gifts in all of them. And one of the things that really just stands out to me is how well designed like so much of this game is. It is one of those games that really makes you feel super powerful, even though in hindsight the game kind of fudges with itself to make it to actually make you have, pull off things that are, for other games would be a little more difficult, but this game actually like allows, gives you, sort of simulates things in such a way that it's like, oh my God, I am like a speed running master. It's actually the, if you pay attention, the game kind of assists you and kind of nudges you in a certain sort of direction in order to do all of this stuff. Like, one of the, I think, more obvious ones is that if you notice, the game kind of has like an auto targeting system, but it's very slight, and it's just enough that, you know, it can make, you know, traversing these levels and taking out these enemies go as fluid as possible without having to, you know, basically 360 no scope every single one of them that you come across. But also just the way all of these levels are designed is just immaculate. And what's especially amazing is the fact that the way that they're all designed, they seem to like have more depth than they actually have. Especially they'll always add on like these sort of ancillary areas that you don't really have to, you know, go to or involve yourself with, and in some cases it'll straight up like move you off course. But because there are like collectibles and stuff in each level, it's just enough of an incentive to actually like go out and explore all of these various courses. And some of them end up having a lot more depth to them than you would actually expect them to have. Also, the game is just like really funny at times, like really laugh out loud funny. But yeah, I'm playing that, and I'm also, you know, playing Baldur's Gate 3 again. I'm now back at the point where you're like underground with the mushroom people. And one of the things about Baldur's Gate 3 that I think kind of the reason why that game still has, you know, wheels the way it does is because there are just like so many things in this game that this relatively small team of people at Larian Studios worked on, where people are like, you know, they're still finding new things. There are just a ton of things in this game that, depending on which way you go, you may never see them. That underground section with the mushroom people I'm talking about, you could actually go through the whole game and never go there. Like, you could completely miss that entire area if you want, if, you know, depending on how you're playing the game. It is not at all required. And yet, there's a bunch of content down there that can end up being story specific, and story relevant if you're willing to explore it. And it's also got, you know, a bunch of little side quests in that area too. And it's just, God, it's so good. It's still an amazing game. You know, even though it's been a couple years now, and people are still finding new shit inside of it. But yeah, that's what I've been playing. So, Danrad, what about you?
Yeah, I know for quite a few weeks now I've been saying I couldn't talk about what I've been playing. I'll finally reveal it now because the embargo lifted over the past week. The main game that I've been playing was Octopath Traveler Zero.
Yeah.
And yeah, so just to give you guys a bit of a background with my Octopath Traveler history, I played the first one. I loved the first one. The first one was actually my game of the year it came out. For reasons I don't remember, but I'm assuming it just came out at a bad time. I never played Part Two. And I know that a lot of people think Part Two is a whole lot better, and like one was really, really good. So you know, I went into Zero, you know, just it was probably the biggest early game I had, and I was like, all right, well, we'll see how it goes. Now, for those of you that don't know, Zero is a sort of a retelling of Octopath Traveler, Champions of the Continent, which is a mobile game that uses a whole lot of gacha mechanics, and that being said, even though it was a mobile game with gacha mechanics, a lot of people that did play it liked it a lot. And I can see why. Like, in regards to the story, if you've played an Octopath before, you know, you're gonna be in pretty familiar ground. And the reason why I really have a lot of respect and admiration for the Octopath games are because the stories are quite dark and mature. You know, like you look at it, and they're primarily known for the fact that they are the first games to make use of Square's HD 2D visual style. But at the same time, like these games go to dark places that you wouldn't even find imaginable. So the main thing with this game is the fact that you, for the first time in the series, actually play as an antagonist. You don't have to choose between like the eight main characters in the game. This doesn't even have that. And that being said, you sort of grow up in this village, and in typical JRPG fashion, that village is overthrown to shit because, apparently they're looking for like this mysterious ring that your main character has. And yeah, they never find it. So in return, they pretty much mess up your town and they kill your family. So, you spend the first few months like plotting your revenge or whatever it may be. But you also, come across all the survivors and say, "Hey, let's go ahead and like restore the town of Wishvale." And like that's one difference between this and the mobile game. The mobile game did have a nameless town, but this game actually sort of marries the whole like restoration of your town with the whole game. So it kind of feels more encompassing that way. And for a lot of people, myself included, the main issue with Octopath Traveler was the fact that the plot felt disjointed because there were eight characters with who had their own motivations. And while it's the same case with this one, because you have a main character, like your quest is always like grounded. You always know what you're supposed to do. Now, the main thing here is that there are three villains in the game, and they focus on wealth, power, and I'm forgetting the other one, but basically it's a way for you to sort of ground your story. And similar to the original Octopath Traveler, like you had to choose your main character out of the eight. So with Octopath Traveler Zero, you have to choose your main path out of those three parts. And as a result, like that's where the game really opens up. So, you leave your town, and at the same time, it's like you have to like decide which paths you really want to go, and the path that you end up choosing is the one that really like resonates with your character. So, how should I put it? The path that I chose was wealth. They ask you like what's more important to you, and when you do that, your main antagonist is going to be this character Herminia, who has this. She is just addicted to the wealth and fortune that she has, and she is like so into it that she literally like gets off on it. And it's totally hilarious because there's this one scene where she's in bed with like two other guys, but at the same time, like this is a 2D game, so it doesn't like look like that when you're playing the game versus when you're playing the 3D game, just because like it has that old school style feel. But that's also where a lot of the charm and the stuff comes from. So when you pursue power, the main bad guy is Tytos, and he's really the main guy that overthrows your town. He is someone who takes the greatest pleasure in murdering your family and your friends, and he has this whole thing of taking every town around him. And then the other one is Fame, and Fame had the best antagonist, in my opinion, in the entire game, as well as in JRPGs in quite a long time. So, the main bad guy with Fame is the playwright, Auguste, who he's absolutely obsessed with the drama in his own writing, and he causes pain and death to the people he who are in his plays for his own enjoyment. So, for example, like he casts a main character and they go through like some sort of hardship, and as a result, like he normally like takes their lives in return, and he is so flamboyant about it. So yeah, it's like it's really interesting going through these three paths, but at the same time, like you can't just pursue one. So even though you choose between wealth, power, and fame, it's not ideal to just go one route because you actually have the other two things that are available to you. And you see this by seeing the suggested level. So, for example, if you're starting off in level 5 and you do the first two chapters in wealth, all of a sudden it's like the last chapter in wealth is going to be like level 14. So if you're level 5 and you try to go to a level 14 area, you're probably going to die. So, you have to actually pursue the actual paths of power and fame and just go through things that way. And so here's like kind of spoiler territory. Like, I'm not really going to talk about the story. I'm pretty much going to talk about the dynamics. After you finish those three parts of the game, you're really only halfway through. more parts open up, and like that's where the game sort of like goes haywire with all the things that you have to do. And that's kind of where the game lost me. For those of you that aren't aware, this is probably the longest game in the series, and it's as a result of giving you more content than you really expect. And when I did some research, apparently a lot of the quote unquote second quests were actually sort of DLC or updates to the mobile game. So it's like, all right, our original mobile game was good. Let's go ahead and add more. And it kind of feels like that. A lot of the second quests feel tacked on. And then you get to the real final last chapter that sort of ties everything together. And it feels nice, but at the same time, a lot of the dungeons and enemies and whatnot, they just feel like they're at a whole separate level as to what's been shown to the rest of the game. And it kind of makes the pacing feel off. I spent around 80 hours in the game before finally rolling credits, the real credits. And honestly, like, I felt like a lot of the time that I spent, in my first 35 hours were a whole lot more fun than in my second 35. And, that's the pacing issue. That comes with the fact that, there's just so much to do. And yeah, like, if you're somebody who finds value in the hours you spend playing your game, compared to the dollar amount, you'll definitely find value here. Like, this is a $50 game. You're probably going to spend 80 to 100 hours doing everything if that's what you want to do. And fine. There are also a lot of side quests in the game, and most of the side quests actually have you gaining different party members. And a lot of the party members you find are actually going to be members of the original Octopath Traveler cast. So, you can have Haunted, you can have Therion, whoever it may be. Those ori that th the original eight are there, and it feels weird because like this game is officially a prequel to Octopath Traveler, but it doesn't feel like canon because if you've played the original Octopath Traveler, you kind of know about their histories to begin with. And this kind of feels disjointed in that regard because like you aren't supposed to know like any of this stuff happens, and then eventually they become main characters in the next game. And it just doesn't make any sense that way. And the main reason that happens is because, you as the protagonist of Octopath Traveler Zero have agency. And when you have agency, you can't really script what happens in the next game because by then it won't make any sense. So that therein lies the problem. Like, look, I really enjoy the 80 hours I spent with the game, but if you're playing for the fact of canon, if you're playing for the purpose of like seeing the entire scope of the story, it doesn't make sense in that regard. It kind of feels like filler. It kind of feels like, it's really just a game for you to have fun, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're trying to like really absorb the Octopath world for what it is, this doesn't essentially matter, and that kind of takes a lot of the enjoyment out of it. That being said, like, the game is a whole lot of fun. If you're looking for an awesome new JRPG that came out this December, this is a wholehearted recommendation. On OpenCritic, Metacritic, it is scoring as high as Metroid Prime 4. So that's an easy recommendation from there. The battle system is still great. The main difference between this one and the previous ones is the fact that you actually have eight characters to control at the same time. And the main way this does this is with two lines. With the original Octopath Traveler, you can only use four characters. And with this one, you have eight. So you have the front line, and all of a sudden, if you want to go ahead and change the one character you have to somebody in the back, you can do that. And this is obviously going to be ideal for a lot of the weaknesses because, Octopath Traveler is all about breaking your opponent's guard. And the main way to do that is by attacking them by the weakness. And the main way to do that is to make sure that you have the most varied weapon choices possible. So because there are over 30 characters in the game, it allows you for a lot of mix and match opportunities. That being said, there also is no super or subclasses in this game. The previous Octopath Traveler had these super classes where you're able to use a whole bunch of different weapons. It's not the case with this one. This one, like, everyone has a maximum of two separate weapons, whether it be, sword and dagger, or certain kinds of magic. Those are the kinds of the limitations they put you through. Eventually, you'll be able to get access to a scholar where they can analyze certain enemies and show the weaknesses that they have. But again, that's not going to be until later in the game. And that being said, like, the Octopath Traveler battle system has always been fun to me. The last point I want to make is the fact that we have this new thing called Path Actions. And Path Actions are pretty cool. If you've played any of the previous Octopath Traveler games, especially when you have job classes such as Merchant or Thief, the cool thing with those classes is that you can go ahead and talk to pretty much any NPC in the game and be able to steal things or buy things from them. And Path Actions are pretty much the equal to those. So, depending on the character you talk to, you can just talk to them. You can also inquire. When you inquire, you'll learn their name, you'll learn about their life story and things like that. And I really enjoyed that, especially as a Trails fan, because Trails is pretty cool in the sense where you can go ahead and then know every character's name in there, know their backstories, even if you never used them. And that I thought that was pretty cool. They also have options where you can like purchase or steal from them. And if you decide to go with those options, they show you your likelihood of actually doing that successfully. If there's a point where you choose to purchase or steal and you fail to do that properly, you end up losing reputation, and all of a sudden, if you don't have any reputation in that town, you can go ahead and go to that bar and make sure you restore it by paying a fee. So it's that kind of stuff that really makes it feel special and makes you actually want to talk to certain NPCs in the game, because I found myself never actually going to a shop. I just really just bought items or stole items from the people in every town, so I thought that was cool. But yeah, like Octopath Traveler Zero is awesome. Whether or not you think you're wasting your time because of the fact that it doesn't re really feel like it's part of the series is going to be a factor in your purchase. But the fact that it's $50 makes it an awesome value to me. So, I definitely recommend that in that regard. The next game I want to talk about is Metroid Prime 4. Chris already went into detail about it. I'm a little bit ahead of where he is. I did get Viola, the motorcycle in the game, and I haven't gotten to a point where I'm really exploring the quote unquote open world with it. I'm in sort of a dungeon where I have to like go from building to building and solve puzzles and get through different enemies in that way. And yeah, so basically with this one, Nintendo sent me a code last Thursday or Friday when the game came out. It turns out that they sent me a Switch 1 code because I noticed that, oh, the frame rate isn't as sharp as I would expect from a Switch 2 game, but I also noticed that it was Switch 1. So I went ahead and paid the $10. Either way, thanks Nintendo. They finally gave me a code. But yeah, the game is easily one of the best looking games on the Switch 2. So that's pretty cool in that regard. The one thing that I'm sort of struggling with is the fact that I'm not really a fan of the aiming with the right stick. I am very traditional in the sense where I really preferred what the original Metroid Prime 1 and 2 did in the GameCube in regards to locking on, strafing, and whatever it may be. I just feel like, being able to aim with either motion controls or the right stick kind of makes it a little bit harder in that regard, so I did struggle against bosses. Luckily, I haven't died yet, so there's that. But like the one reason why I've really been enveloped or really like this game actually clicked faster than I thought it would is because this game is really a Zelda game. Metroid has typically been about exploration. I really haven't felt that with this yet, but when you unlock certain things that Samus's suit are able to do, you're using a lot of these aspects right away. One thing that I unlocked is the I forget what the actual thing is called, but it's the psychic laser where all of a sudden you go into your psychic scanning mode and you go ahead and throw a charge beam, and the charge beam actually is something that you can fully control. So a lot of the bosses in the game will actually force you to use that beam so that you can take three weak points out at the same time. And that's really been the main way to defeat a lot of these bosses. So it has that Zelda Ocarina of Time feel of unlocking this new weapon, using that weapon to your heart's content, and it really being your answer to everything. And I definitely have found that really cool so far. When you solve certain puzzles or kill like enemies in an arena, you have that typical Metroid chime the way that Zelda would. And yeah, it definitely feels like a Zelda in that regard. So if you're somebody that kind of misses the way Zelda used to be, with Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, Twilight Princess, Wind Waker, it kind of feels like that, except you're playing a first-person shooter. Not so much a first-person shooter like Call of Duty, but the fact that you definitely have that, option there. So I've really enjoyed that aspect. I've played around 3 to 4 hours of the game, and I'm looking forward to playing the rest. The last game I want to play is, or I've played for a bit, is Skate Story. The review should come out. I mean, by the time this podcast comes out, the review will already be out. And honestly, as of right now, I'm going to play a lot more tonight, but as of right now, I'm not really liking the game. The reason being, well, first of all, just to explain Skate Story. Skate Story is an independent game out of Devolver. They're the publisher, and basically it's an independent game reliant on skateboarding. And I've had issues with a lot of independent skateboarding games, mainly Skatebird and things like that, primarily because it plays less like Tony Hawk and more like Skate, and I'm not a skate guy. So it's kind of hard to sort of like reverse engineer how I play Tony Hawk to play one of these games. And to put it most plainly, and this isn't even going to make a whole lot of sense, Skate Story is just weird. Like, you're like this glass character from hell, and you want to use skate tricks to kill a whole lot of bosses. It's both awesome and archaic in the sense where, yeah, it's hard to get used to the controls if you're used to Tony Hawk. But at the same time, it's like a lot of the conversations that are had with the skater just are weird for the sake of being weird. And I know that it's inherently like that, but because of that, I haven't really found much of a reason for it to click with me. I'm about maybe an hour and a half into my play so far, and from what I've heard from the PR team, it's gonna take like 5 hours to roll credits. I don't know if I'll actually get there, but that's definitely been a struggle in that regard. I know that this game is coming to PlayStation Plus or whatever it may be, so yeah, like I hope it succeeds, but so far it hasn't clicked with me yet. But yeah, like I didn't actually expect to play Metroid because I also never expect to get a code from Nintendo, but once I get through all this stuff, I do want to jump back into Pokemon Legends Zha. I do want to play Ghost of Yote. We have Game of the Year coming up pretty soon, so I definitely want to get through all those. But yeah, that's definitely been about it for me.
All right, so yeah, let's get to some news. And first off, we'll start with a death of a legend in the let's say video game movie space.
Yeah.
Gary Hiroyuki Tagawa, who passed away at 75. If you know your early video game movie history, he was a Shang Tsung in the first Mortal Kombat movie in 1995. Sort of a great actor for that role. Very intimidating and all that. And yeah, it seems like he passed away due to complications from a stroke. So sad to see, but yeah, it was a big part of the early Mortal Kombat sort of legacy, I guess. And he returned to play that role in Mortal Kombat 11 for the Shang Tsung version there that they did from the movie. And it was also, I think, in the mobile game for the same reason for that. So, yeah, he was also in the live action Tekken movies where he was Heihachi Mishima, which I'm pretty sure nobody saw any of those. So there's that, because it was 2011. Nobody was thinking about Tekken movies at that point, especially because I don't think they were in theaters or anything. But yeah, he was a great actor for Mortal Kombat, and shame to see him go. But we're at that kind of point where people in those movies from 30 years ago, unfortunately, 30 years older than they were then. So you start seeing some of them die here in the next probably 10, 15, 20 years for
Yeah,
some of them.
sadly.
So yeah, there you go for that unfortunate news. We'll get to some more positive news here. Because we got a bunch of games that are going to be coming out in the next few months. First up here, Tomba 2, The Evil Swine Returns Special Edition. Will be out December 15th for PS5, Switch, Switch 2, and PC. Seems like they're no longer planning the PS4 version of that release, but yeah, so you can check that out. Yeah, Tsushima 2 was the sequel that essentially took the same general kind of gameplay style, but brought it to a 3D world instead of a 2D world. So you can kind of explore these environments in more of a full 3D sense. So I don't think you had a ton of freedom of movement. So I think you were still locked into lanes as this, the way that it worked. But you explored, solved puzzles and quests and all that kind of stuff. So that looks like that should be a pretty fun revisit. So yeah, that'll be a $20 here on the 15th. So
All
that'll
right.
be next week. There's that. Let's see. On the January 20th, we've got Mio: Memories in Orbit, a Metroid-y game that will be, let's see, coming to PS5, Xbox, Switch 2, and PC. Seems like they have dropped the PS4 and Xbox One versions of this game. But yeah, this comes from developer Doze Dixiems. I think it's French, so I'm not sure how to pronounce that so much. But it's the developers from Shady Part of Me that made that game. This is a Metroid-y game. I played the demo of this last summer during one of the Steam Next Fest things, and it's a really cool kind of post robot apocalypse world. Playing as a robot, kind of exploring this facility and finding the robots that remain that can help you on your journey, and taking out the ones that have become malfunctioning and evil. So one of those kind of games, some really nice art style and art to this, so that one seems like it's worth checking out for that. There's
All right.
that one. That'll be January.
Yeah.
Also in January, Cairn seems like it'll finally release. This one has been delayed a few times.
Yeah.
The newest game from the Game Bakers, makers of a handful of games, Fury Haven, and I think of maybe one more game outside of that. But this is their new one that is essentially a rock climbing game, made more of a survival version of that compared to some of the ones we've seen before, like Jusant. It's more of an adventure game of sorts. It seems like they'll have plenty of gameplay here. They say 15 hours of playtime for that, so I'm curious to see this one. I have the demo, I've not started it yet, but that one looks like that could be pretty cool. And yeah, that'll be on PS5 and PC. Let's see, $30 with a 10% launch discount. They have a $37 deluxe edition with a travel guide by comic book artist Matthew Bablett and three exclusive keepsakes. So little extra things for the character there. So there's that to look forward to. Then in February, Romeo is a Dead Man will be out February 11th for $49.99, it seems, for PS5, Xbox, and PC. The newest Grasshopper game, self-published as well. So they're doing their own thing, and it seems like that's very Suda 51 kind of style of game that is very ridiculous and bloody and over the top kind of game. As you got this guy who has been turned into like a robot man, and now he's just killing tons of people with his swords and guns and all that. So yeah, that one looks like it's going to be pretty neat for that. So there you go. Then on February 19th, we got Wizman's World Retry. This is a DS JRPG that I don't think ever came over to the West, but will be. Yeah, they first did this remaster back in May of last year. Let's see. I'll be on PS5, PS4, Switch, and PC. Yeah, looks really neat. Has a really nice art style to it. It's a very, you can maybe say HD 2D kind of look to it. It's not pixelated, the backgrounds and all that. The that stuff looks all It was more of a natural art style, but all the characters are pixelated. But you got your JRPG stuff. It looks like a timeline of which enemies are going to attack when, and you're strategizing what you're going to do based on that. So that looks neat. Yeah, looks really neat. So that'll be February 19th. No price I see here. So yeah, there you go for that one. And then let's see, March 12th will be Replaced, a game that's been in the works for quite a while for Xbox and PC. It'll also be on Game Pass. Yeah, this was supposed to come out ages ago. I'm trying to see when we got the first announcement for this game. That was 4 years ago when it got announced at, I think, the Xbox showcase. Yeah, June 2021. So that'll be out in March. So we'll hopefully see that actually come out. Could still get delayed, but we'll see.
This is one I definitely have my eye on, 'cause it's just a bunch of stuff that I love. It's got that sort of retro kind of 2D approach, even though it's, the graph pixely approach, cyberpunk-ish, just looks really cool.
Is that the only one you're interested in, Brandon?
Well, no, Wiseman's World also looks pretty cool.
How about you, Dinner?
Yeah, I mean, like there's a bunch out of here. I mean, not a bunch, but a good amount. Tombo 2 is one thing, is one game that I grew up with, but never actually beat. So there's interest there. Mio: Memories of Orbit seems interesting. I don't know if it's interesting enough for me to want to get to it right away. I don't even know how to pronounce Cairn or Cairn or whatever it may be. That's a game that I've seen in a lot of preview events. So that's probably going to be the one game that I do give a try. And then Romeo's a Dead Man. That is I love Suda 51 stuff, but that is also probably going to be tough to get to, especially with like Yakuza and Trails happening during that time period. But I'd love to get to it.
So yeah, some nice stuff looking for the early part of next year. We also got some other news here. Celador Games, makers of Rogue Legacy, have announced their next game, which looks like it's going to be a roguelike strategy RPG called Neath, as in like beneath, but without the B. So yeah, out next year for PC only at the moment. Yeah, they say they're inspired by Into the Breach, but also tabletop games like Mansions of Madness. Yeah, a game they've been kicking around for a while to make, and so this seems like they have got it down and look to be releasing this next year. Yeah, roguelike tactical RPG set in a decaying world shadowed by an irradiated inverted tower. They got a turn-based system. Yeah, looks really neat from the art style and all that, so I'm definitely looking forward to this. That team does some really cool stuff. So yeah, I'm curious to see more of this, so yeah, that's one to keep an eye on whenever that one's ready. Let's see, we got some news on Ball Pit, which has reached 1 million copies sold. And as a celebration of that, they have announced that they've got three big updates coming for next year. Particularly, they got the Regal update for January 2026. April is the Shadow update, and July is the Naturalist update. They say each will feature new balls, new evolutions, new buildings, new characters, and more. So I'm excited to see more content in that game. It already has plenty of it, but now they got some more stuff to throw in there. So I'm curious to see where that all is going to go. So that's good to see. Definitely recommend checking that one out. Let's see, we also got some more news. Sony has announced they are publishing the next game from Bad Robot Games, the game division of J.J. Abrams' film studio. It seems like it'll be a co-op shooter that's being directed by the Left 4 Dead creator, Mike Booth. So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we haven't seen much of Bad Robot games. The only reason why I know them is because I have applied to work there a couple times. But given that, they have a company like PlayStation backing them from here, that has to be good news from them. But at the same time, it's like, do we want another shooter from PlayStation? I don't know.
But yeah, this looks like it's gonna be coming to PS5 and PC sometime in the future, so probably still pretty early on this one. So yeah. What were you saying, Brandon?
I was going to say the one thing I do know about Bad Robot Games is they helped produce Weird West, which was that sort of top-down action RPG that was like a horror western that I actually liked a lot. But yeah, that's pretty much all I know them for. I mean, I know what Bad Robot is. I know it's like J.J. Abrams' production company. But they haven't really done any serious gaming projects that have really taken off other than that one.
But yeah, Mike Booth has some good credentials on him, so hopefully he's got some interesting stuff going on here. So we'll find out more about that at a later date, I assume. But yeah. Let's see. Yeah, we'll get to some more serious news. Horses came out, but not on all the platforms it was even going to be on, as Epic Game Store banned it about 24 hours before launch. Yeah, I think they what was it here? Yeah, they said they received an email from Epic Games in which the company explained it was unable to distribute the horror game because it violates the Epic Game Store content guidelines, specifically the inappropriate content and hateful or abusive content policies. So yeah, they got the whole text of the email here. Seem to believe that if it were rated for the ESRB, it would be an AO game. And then, yeah, saying that AO rated games could not be distributed on the game store. Which, yeah, they say the only exception is for products and cases where an AO rating was applied solely due to the usage of blockchain or NFT technology, which is a weird caveat there, but. Yeah, then also as part of its release, I think the day of release, Humble Game Store took it down to kind of review it and then just put it back up, being like, this is okay. So kind of weird to get the two of the biggest storefronts being unwilling to host this game, claiming it's too content is too terrible for hosting on the storefront, and then Itch and GOG and Humble Bundle have, I think all would have DRM free versions of it for $5 that you could get. Pretty much no fuss, no muss. And from what I've heard of people that play the game, have been like confused why this is such a big deal from the release version. But I believe some of the details of what was changed does make sense a bit, but also the way that the game is sort of framed, it's essentially about people, I believe, are sent to this farm if they are either political dissidents or, I forget what the other kind of thing would be, but they're sent to this farm where they have a horse mask attached to their head with like a sort of like collar, keeping it from being taken off, and sort of kept there until they have lost their degeneracy, I think. The nature of what that degeneracy is, changes from character to character, but also it's a game that's like a couple hours long, so it doesn't seem like it revels in any of it. So yeah, this just weird for a game that doesn't seem like it's as bad as the way that these storefronts are acting about it, and it very much that's more so than the rules these storefronts act on vibes. And so the studio kind of talking about the Steam banishment kind of puts people at these other storefronts on high alert, and probably seeing some of the talk where people were saying this had CSAM in it, which I think that is child sexual abuse material. Claiming that it was built around that, and does not seem like that was really the case. Maybe had a little bit of leaning towards that early on, but seems like they made changes for that stuff to make it clear. But yeah, but from what I've seen, people have been liking it so far. That have been playing it, but not really anything major about it being like super offensive or anything. So it feels like at least Epic here is overreacting. But yeah. Not really much else to add on that.
No, it just it was this it just I it's just weird how like you said, the game had none of that like material that would cause all of these alarm bells to go off, and yet to a man it did. I don't and we don't really know why.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question there for Steam and Epic. So there you go. But yeah, speaking of games that were rejected, there was a new Postal game that was announced. I believe supposed to be sort of a Vampire Survivors like that they described as like a bullet heaven shooter. They announced it on December 3rd, and then was removed and canceled within 2 days, because a bunch of people in the Running with Scissors community found what they thought were signs of AI use in the game and rejected it so badly that Running with Scissors had to apologize and cancel the game and, cancel the contract with the studio that was working on it, which was named Goon Swarm Games. Just in case you want to know where these people are coming from. So yeah, they went all the big on this announcement and canceled it very quickly because of AI stuff. And so it's like, this is the most respect I've had for Running with Scissors in the last like 12 years, considering they've been a big part of the first ring, first run of Gamergate as like one of the key developers supporting them, and then making another shit Postal game and doing more like remasters of the other ones and all that. So yeah, they posted a big thing about this, apologizing and saying they have other Postal games on the way. So the community rejected it, and it's nice to see that bullying works. So yeah, there you go for that one. That's was a fun story to see of a game I wasn't really interested in, and now I don't have to worry about it even then. So there you go. Let's see. Now we'll get to the Netflix news because they have a couple bits here. The biggest one is that they are the ones that have won the money contest for acquiring Warner Brothers from Warner Brothers Discovery. They'll be taking on a lot of the Warner Brothers side of it, a lot of the movie and DC and HBO stuff and all that, as well as the games part of the company, which means they'll have NetherRealm, Rocksteady, and the other studios there under their umbrella once this goes through, which can probably take at least until next summer, if not longer, to fully go through. Because this is an $82.7 billion acquisition at the moment. It'll certainly give Netflix a more concrete development division here, because they've tried to build up their own big studio and just did not seem to want to keep that going for the full length of making a full game. They end up canceling that and laying off a bunch of people. So this kind of gives them a shortcut through that with a bunch of veteran studios that should be much better for what they want to do. And will probably, I think, at least focus on just letting them work on what they're working on. Yeah, they'd have NetherRealm, Avalanche, Rocksteady, and TT Games, the Lego studio, and a few other studios as well, WB Montreal. I think some mobile studios as well. So yeah, that'll make them of a serious publisher with all that, as well as access to, various properties that they could make games for. We'll see how that all goes, but yeah, that's an interesting wrinkle in all this is that Netflix becomes one of the more interesting publishers in the industry that needs interesting publishers at this point. So yeah, there you go for that one. And let's see, we got the other story here, which is in lieu of not wanting to kind of continue their partnership with this company that they purchased, they have sold Spry Fox and the properties within Cozy Grove and the one they're working on right now, Spirit Crossing, back to the founders of Spry Fox, Daniel Cook and David Ettery. So now that's yeah, so the original founders will be able to kind of keep the studio going and keep working on the cool little games that they have been working on, which is good. Always good when this kind of option pops up for these kinds of studios. Instead of just shutting them down and making them have to start over again, they can kind of keep things going and kind of do what they want to do with their new independence. So that is great to see. Which I imagine as they were kind of finalizing the Warner Brothers sale, maybe this was something they saw as like, well, if we're gonna get into this kind of business of big game publishing, maybe we don't need these smaller studios that can easily get left behind and all that, and probably getting the letting the studio kind of go off on its own and do its own thing. So yeah, that's always good. Good to see. So yeah, that's your Netflix news for the week. I don't know if you have anything to add, Brandon.
Nope.
Yeah, I mean, like the main thing I have to add here is like, obviously from a consumer standpoint, like maybe the WB acquisition is exciting, but at the same time, like we'll probably see price changes on the negative side for Netflix. And at the same time, like I know a bunch of people who work for all those companies, and they're scared, and they have reason to be. So yeah, prepare.
Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, there you go for that stuff. Speaking of acquisitions, we have some new financial details of the EA acquisition that included Saudi Arabia and a few other companies there, like Jared Kushner's equity firm and all that. It seems like the basically, the studio's going or the company is going to be run by Saudi Arabia, who own I think 93.4% of the new form of EA, and so they'd basically be the ones calling the shots, which is not really a surprise. But some people were under the assumption that it might be a group effort or something like that. But no, this is essentially Saudi Arabia buying one of the biggest publishers in the industry and kind of doing some probably going to be doing some not so fun stuff here, especially as they're putting a huge load of debt onto the company to have them figure out how they're going to pay that off. So that'll be fun, really fun to see how that goes here for the next couple years for EA.
Yeah, we'll see, won't we? And in the
Yeah.
meantime, I'm gonna do my best to avoid every EA production like the plague.
Yeah. It's not going to be a fun time, especially for the people that just don't want to support companies that are owned by the Saudis at this point, which right now in the gaming sphere is basically SNK and EA.
If I have to pirate the next Mass Effect game in order to not support EA right now, then I will do it.
Probably get it from GameStop.
Yeah, I could probably just get it secondhand. That's also true.
Go the lesser of the evils there. But yeah, there you go for that. We also got this news from Ron Gilbert in that the lack of sort of financial support and funding from publishers and other companies means that he has had to cancel his upcoming RPG project. This is one that he described at a certain point as Classic Zelda meets Diablo meets Thimbleweed Park to be sort of an action adventure RPG kind of thing. And yeah, the shots I've seen of this game has a really great look to it and all that, which is a shame. But yeah, he did release the other game that's I'm not sure if they mentioned it here in this article. I'm blanking on the name of it. The sort of screen scrolling kind of RPG game that at least came out earlier this year. So that's good news. But yeah, this is certainly something that would have been cool to see. Ron Gilbert has had outside of some of his mostly made adventure games and has had some interest in trying out other genres and such. So like he worked on the on some other stuff in this vein, particularly the, I forget what the name of the game is called, the action RPG series he worked on for a bit. There's also The Cave was another one he worked on. He's done some of this stuff, but yeah, shame that he was not able to find the funding for this one, which is a shame. As he says here, doing a pixelated old school Zelda thing isn't the big hot item. The publishers look at us and they didn't look at it as we're going to make $100 million and it's worth investing in. The amount of money they're willing to put up and the deals they were offering just made absolutely no sense to me to go do this. And notes how publishers are very analytics driven right now. Makes it difficult to pitch concepts compared to when he was starting his career. They have formulas that they apply to games to try to figure out how much money they could make. In the end, you end up giving a whole lot of games that look exactly the same as last year's game because that makes some money. When we were starting out, we couldn't do that because we didn't know what made this money, so it was a lot more experimenting. That's why I really enjoy the indie game market because it's kind of free of a lot of that stuff that big publishers bring to it. There's a lot more creativity, strangeness, and bizarreness, so which is definitely not wrong with that. A lot of publishers want their own form of the big thing that makes money, and hopefully it makes more money. But yeah, big enough for that for some Ron Gilbert news, and we'll go to the next one here with Three Fields Entertainment, makers of Recreation Studio, as well as a bunch of other racing stuff. The that's head up by the former founders of Criterion Games, the makers of Burnout, have announced that they have on LinkedIn that they have put the entire studio on notice for redundancy. Yeah. CEO Fiona Sperry saying here today, I'm having to share one of the hardest messages of my career. After 12 years of building and nurturing Three Fields Entertainment, I'm forced into the situation of today, placing our entire team on notice of redundancy. Yeah, they keep going on here, talk about how the studio itself has had to self-fund most of this year and all of the post-launch content. After doing so for months, leadership simply cannot sustain the studio in its current form. As a result, the post is both a public announcement of the redundancies and a call to potential business partners that can help fund a studio as it finds its footing. Yeah, they essentially built a game that would need a lot of funding, and THQ Nordic seems like they were uninterested in meeting that even halfway if the studio had to fund much of this game's budget themselves. And so, yeah, that's a shame. It's a studio that has a lot of good people there working on probably smaller staff levels and budgets than you would expect from the sort of quality of games they've been putting out here. So, yeah, hopefully they can find a path forward for this, but I would not be surprised if that ends up being it for the studio, which would be unfortunate. So, yeah, there you go for some sad news.
Very sad news, unfortunately. But that is the way the way the industry is right now.
Yeah, and sort of part of that, Tencent has announced that they are halting marketing of Light of Motorum as their lawsuit with Sony has a court date of January 29th. So that whole thing will be starting off here in about a month or so, as Sony is suing Tencent for its slavish clone of the Horizon series that has requested a preliminary injunction. While that waits to be heard in court, Tencent has agreed to hold off public tests and pause the marketing of its upcoming action game, which is slated to release in Q4 2027. They've also promised not to bring the release window forward until the case has been heard. Yeah, so they are filing a copyright lawsuit against Tencent. They've demanded a jury trial for copyright and trademark infringement, and to prevent the imminent release of this new game, accusing it of ripping off Horizon lead Aloy, deliberately causing numerous game lovers to confuse Light of Motorim as the next game in the Horizon series, with encountering Tencent's promotional gameplay videos and social media accounts and all that, which, yeah, they're not really wrong. That's it has a lot of the style of the Horizon games. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I'm sure there'll be plenty of coverage of this so we can see more of what the arguments for this, for and against this are early next year. So yeah, that'll be interesting to see. So there you go for that one. Keep an eye on. Then we got just a little bit of lighter news, but Japanese devs are facing a bit of an issue here as one of the main font providers has decided they're going to hike their rates from an annual plan price of $380 to $20,000 or more. Seems like maybe around $20,500 US here, which is a huge increase. That's very ridiculous for what they're offering here, but it seems like the sort of thing where they know they provide a service that few others can do for this font work, and they decided they want to exploit the various game companies that are using it. Yeah, this expensive replacement plan offered through Fontwork's parent company Monotype doesn't even provide local for Japanese developers. Comes with a 25,000 user cap, which is likely not workable for Japan's bigger studios. The problem is further compounded by the difficulties and complexities of securing fonts that can accurately describe transcribe kanji and katakana characters. There are some free fonts that can do that stuff decently well, but not to the extent the paid stuff can do. But it is becoming a big issue that we'll see if it see how they try to get around this. Yeah, we'll see where this goes. But yeah, that's surprising, but also not surprising. But it seems like somebody who's kind of cornered a market decides it's time to hike their rates on that stuff. And Japan's not immune to that. So yeah, I don't know if you have anything to add on any of that.
Honestly, I do think it's kind of weird that, when you, this is kind of like, I'm trying to put this into words, that makes some sort of sense. There's something really weird about, like, I understand, like, yeah, they're the creator of the font, and they, therefore hold the rights to it. Obviously, they deserve compensation of some kind, but I don't know what you can say to justify that kind of price hike for something like that.
Yeah. Just
Like,
exploitation.
yeah.
Yeah, like this is obvious exploitation, but at the same time, the people being exploited are, one of the biggest companies in the world. So
Oh
there's
yeah,
sort of like
obviously.
there's obviously a balance there. Just looking at Nintendo specifically, I'm pretty sure they'll just look elsewhere. And as a Nintendo fan, it gives me excitement in the sense where, like, we're going to see some uniqueness here. But at the same time, we're talking about fonts, so I don't really care.
Yeah,
True.
it's just a sign of things that are happening, as we've seen with PC components with like RAM and all that are going up into ridiculous prices because they want to supply their products to AI data centers, such that are growing up now. And so we'll see if you're wondering why the next round of price increases for consoles and computers and all that are going to be happening. It's because of AI. You'll see a lot of that stuff. And I was thinking about buying or building a new PC, and it's like, oh boy, I might just try and bring the RAM over, maybe see what I can do about that, because it's definitely do not want to be paying extra a couple hundred dollars for the same kind of RAM I have now. And I'd so yeah, it's just it's happening in every way that the this stuff can happen, and unfortunately people are seeing that they can do whatever they want. But yeah, we'll end on this last story here with Aerith's voice actor, Brianna White, was calling out people on social media for sending smut using their, the characters they voice directly to them on social media. Particularly this was in relation to a video of Rei Ami, the singing voice of Zoe in K-pop Demon Hunters, who posted a video being like, what are words here? No, seriously, because y'all are so spicy, like OMG. She has a video for a minute being like, she's not inherently against it, but people keep asking her about poly tricks, which I think I suppose the shipping of the three girls from
All three
Huntrix
members,
being romantically interested in each other, and being kind of annoyed at people just sending and her videos and pictures and such, and being like, if she wants to engage with it, she will, but she doesn't want it forced onto her in a way. And Brianna joins in on this to basically say, maybe let's normalize not tagging voice actors in smut of their characters. Some of y'all have forgotten the meaning of the word inappropriate.
Yeah, seriously.
And it's very much like that whole thing. People have lost the learning of shame in the internet age. Yep, voice actors definitely don't. A lot of voice actors like to interact with the community, but don't want to be forced to engage with the porn side of it. At least without consent, essentially. But yeah, this is one of those things that you don't see a lot of because these people probably keep it to themselves in a sense, because they don't want to upset their fans and whatnot. But yeah, it's also something that people on the internet these days don't have any filters, anything that I guess mentally tells them to keep this to themselves.
Yeah, seriously. Like let's be really clear here. Smut is not the problem. Making the smut is not the problem. Wanting to share that smut on the internet, also not really a problem. Sending it unsolicited to people who didn't want to hear it, that is sexual harassment.
Yeah.
Like just
Assuming
straight
it's
up.
probably more commonly sent to women than men.
I mean, yeah. That's part of the poison of social media is that, it's created a atmosphere where, like you said, people just don't have filters anymore.
Yeah. They just think, oh, everybody wants to see anything that involves their character. When it's like, probably not.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So yeah, that's just a fun but also disgusting thing that's been bubbling up here, seems like of late on the internet. So yeah, just in case you're wondering if people are being normally point, no, they're not. Still not finding any way to engage with this stuff in any way that's, yeah, it's just inappropriate. So yeah, that'll end it for the show this week. But yeah, thank you, Brandon and Dana, for joining this week.
Always.
We'll be back next week. I think we got probably a couple more shows here, because I think we'll do our Game of the Year show on the 28th and sort of post that on the first with the rest of with the site list for that. I assume there won't be much going on that at the end of the year. We'll see how things are looking, but we might have two normal shows here for the rest of the year, and probably do a good look at what's coming out in early 2026.
Yeah, we have like probably three unique stories before we just.
So yeah, we'll be winding things down for 2025 as we figure out our game of the year stuff. And if you enjoy the show, for let friends and family know, they should check it out and select strangers who are also interested in seeing if 2026 is any better than this year.
I'm
Because
crossing my fingers, but I'm not holding my breath.
2025 has been pretty bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you all for tuning in. Hope you have a good week ahead. We will see you all next time. Have a good one.
Bye.
See you.